Mad About Denali
on KCLR.
Over the years, Ireland has produced some of the sleekest, swiftest and successful racehorses in the world. They are bred, trained and ridden by a dedicated bunch of passionate people who bring excitement to all corners of the country. At one time, a Carlow horse was the centre of such excitement.
Big, strong horse, but very well put together.
Tall, about 16'2", not much white in him, a small bit of white around the fetlock joint and that. We'd call it hardy, dark bay.
He sort of looked a little bit like a colt, but he was sort of built a bit like a sprinter in a way.
A lot of muscle. He had very, very strong hindquarters, great legs.
Good physical specimen, yeah.
Denali.
This is the story of a racehorse called Denali.
He was a good horse, a great horse.
And it's Denali on the far side being challenged all the time by Dorrit's Pride and Carew's coming down the same side.
The story begins with a girl from Mitchell called Olivia, who just loved horses.
I just loved horses as a kid. As a child, pony mad. Everything was just horses. I'd even watch westerns just to watch horses on television. That's how mad into horses I was, yeah.
Her mother Tess loved them too.
I wanted to have foals around the farm. I loved foals. I'd say, oh yeah, when are you going to buy the mare? And yeah, oh I will, I'll ask them foal. Yeah.
The man saying, I will, was Tess's husband, Olivia's father, Dan O'Neill, who had the gift of the bone setting.
As far as I'm concerned, it's a gift from God. It's in the family for generations. As a matter of fact, my father couldn't do it. There was an uncle of mine used to do it. He lived over the road there. And he only had one daughter, and she was a nun. And she went off. When anything happened to him, that was the end of it. And I was the only male O'Neill around the place. And I fell right. He was about 3 weeks dead, and I fell right up from Tullow one evening. He says, the young one's after falling and something on her arm. But I was the child that night, and I felt something on the wrist there. I said, I think that wrist is out. Well, he says, if it is you, put it back. He says, in you do it and go and do it, don't down the name. You're the only one left now. And I won't leave here, you try it. And I said, fair enough, you'll play a chance, I'll chance it, but don't blame me if it goes wrong. So I caught the hand, gave it a bit of a twist and a click back in. He said, now can't you do it? And started now. And that was the beginning of it. That's 1960 I started.
Since that time, all forms of life, like cats, dogs, sheep, cows and horses, of course, have all limped up to the gates of the O'Neill house to get fixed. Over 20 years ago, Tom Foley, a friend of the family and a dairy farmer, came to the house with a bad back. At that time, he was starting to branch into the horses, so Dan asked his assistance in choosing a horse for Olivia and Tess, and so they made arrangements to meet at the horse sale in Goffs.
I met him. He said, they're not a decent filly in it. But one horse, he said, if he had money, he'd buy him. He says, come down and look at him. So I went down and looked at him. He's only another horse as far as I was concerned. And he was talking for a few minutes and he said, now, if you want the horse, and if you can get this fella for 7,000, I think you should have him. He walked away then. I walked down there and caught with a vet. I was doing a horse for a trainer down there. Every time I'd go down, two or three horses he looked at. Mm. This fella called me over. He's interested in that fella, Dan. Ah, I said, I think Tom is. That's all right, not yourself. She says he's not a horse at all. And he went out unsold at 5'8", and no one ever went near them. We left him surely 2 hours. And they were just gathering up the things to go home, and I went over and asked if they wanted to sell him. He said, that's what they brought him for. He said, you'd have to make 8, of course, off from 6. He wouldn't hear it. Well, I said, I tell you what, I'll do a divide through 1,000, 7,000. I said, that's it. He said, no. I said, fair enough, bring him home and change your mind in a week, let me know. But I said, that's the price. Rang 3 or 4 days after and gave him to me.
When I went to look at him in the sales, every time I went to him, he was lying flat out in the house and asleep. So at that stage, we were wondering, was he a horse that was kind of looking for a good time, or would he ever make a race horse?
Yeah.
But it still didn't put us off in anyhow, and we bought him.
It was like a dream come true that I actually could have a race horse and go and race in it.
I didn't mind, really. We had a racehorse.
The The horse was bred from the Parson and Blaze Gold at Austin's in Clochjordan, and he arrived almost reluctantly to the O'Neill household.
Oshry was a mad hatter. He came here. I went for him, actually. Where was it? Clochjordan. We weren't back until around 11 o'clock at night. And they couldn't get him into the house anyway. And they had to go over to Tom Foley and bring him. We weren't able to manage him. And he came back here and he used to go in and out with the cows. Yeah, and he'd have to cross the road. Holy Moses, if we had known how good he was, we wouldn't have been chancing him across the road. That's all we had him then. We never got him after that.
He was too good.
Tom Foley's died, we'd let some napping him.
From the minute he was broken, he done a, you know, really showed up that he was a racehorse. We used to bring him up now to Jim Bulger's and work him up there. But in the wind-up, we had very few horses that had go up with him because he made it too hard for him. He used to make them work harder than they wanted to do it. And you couldn't bring up the one horse very often because he'd put him to their drills very, very quick.
And so it came to pass that the horse initially ignored at the auction in Goffs started to become interesting to the horse racing fraternity.
I think he knew himself he was pretty good.
I was in Falls one day before he raced, and Tom said he could sell that horse now. He said you get double your money, I could get 15,000 for him. And 15,000 and never rated, 8,000 pound profit in a few months. And I came back and told him. The wife says, "You'll do no such thing," she says. "You want something to get you going," she says. "So we won't sell him." So she says, "When he wins an odd race and pays his way, that's all you want." And he did more than that.
He won his first race in Naas, the Philip A. McCartan Memorial, on the 31st of October 1992.
The talk always when you're in the stable yard is what's going to win and what's going to win. But there were so many going to win the bumper, we decided, well, we had very little chance.
A2's was favoured that day. Brother-in-law, my wife, three of us were in the parade ring and they were coming out. Seamus, his brother-in-law, said, "God," he said, "we never backed him."
And then we said, "Here, quick, we put a bet on." So Mammy, Daddy, Uncle Seamus and myself, and they were all giving me a tenner to put on the horse, right, and go to the tote or go to the bookies, wherever, like. And Mammy then drives me back here and put a tenner on the tours. And I said, "I will not, you're not backing against our horse." And she goes, "Go on, put a tenner on the tours." And I was like, "No, I'm not."
How much do you think we got?
How much?
£637 for 15 euro each way. He was 37.21 on the tote. He was 17 to 1 on the bookies.
So we forgot about actually the bet. We did actually forget about the bet, we were so delighted. Yeah, and then here the one started in the tote. I was like, "God, this actually couldn't be for me." And she kept going and going. And I was like, "God, am I, this is not mine." And then she goes, "Well done." And she handed me back this wad. And I didn't even know what she told me it was. And then I went back to Mammy and she says, "How much did you get?" And I was like, "Open your bag quick, have a quirl of money." And she was like,
yeah. Oh, it was a great day that day.
Oh, sure, it was a great thrill.
It was exciting and that, and I know Danny was very excited because it was his first runner and first winner. Mm. And he came into the arena and he was as white as a ghost at the time, and he just walked up to me and he said, "The horse is not for sale." And even that day, we were offered 30,000 for the horse.
Tom and Dan had to put up the not for sale sign regularly during Dunoli's career. They loved him and he loved racing and he loved them loving him racing.
He loved racing.
Oh, he loved racing. Yeah. Sure, he loved racing, yeah.
He got to the stage, he knew there was an awful lot of people going to see him and he loved getting to the parade ring.
He won, very hard to hold him. And if he was second or third, he'd just walk in.
Really?
An extraordinary horse, yeah. So.
When there'd be a clap and that, he knew that he was at the back of it, that it meant that much to him as well. No badness or nothing in him. Now, he'd go into the house, and he'd always be there looking for feed. No matter how much feeding you give him, he'd eat it all and look for more.
Really?
And he wouldn't leave you in the bed in the morning. He'd be rapping on the door looking for his feed first thing in the morning.
At this stage, Denoli was doing really well on the racetrack, and Tom Foley and the O'Neill family had got used to his winning ways.
He won his first 5 races, and the 6th one he came third, wasn't it?
Yeah. He was sick. The lad behind us, Winterbell, Prendergast horse, won it.
Winterbell
won it, and the man behind it, there's the great horse now, Denoli.
Didn't we tell you he could be beaten, didn't we?
Of course, we were so defensive of poor Denoli. I said, that wasn't a race at all. It was no pace. It was a sprint.
We cried. We really cried. Yeah. Cried hard. Yeah. And the neighbours came over, Nolans and them came over, and look, at he'll win many a race still, don't worry about him. And indeed he did.
He was indeed the talk of the totes, and the races were getting mapped out for him in advance.
I remember the first year we were... After winning our 3 bumpers, and we were kind of deciding whether we'd go for the bumper in Cheltenham and that. And Danny said to me, he says, if he was your horse, what would you do? Mm. Well, I said, there's a bumper in Punchestown. And I said, I'd go for that. The horse was home and in his stable that night. He was going on his holidays after that. And I said, he'd be going out and enjoying himself well. So we went for the bumper in Punchestown, and he won it 15-20 lengths or something that day, and there was a lot of talk for a couple of different horses in it, okay. But he won it very, very easy. Mm. And I remember that day, and we're coming out along back into the parade ring and heading back out along for the stable and all, and Ned said, yous don't deserve a horse like him when yous wouldn't go to Cheltenham. And I just said to him, well, I said, there's many a horse that after going to Cheltenham in the bumpers and never were tell of after. It's a hard race. And they're young horses in that. I said, this fella will be out in the field tomorrow. I said, he'll enjoy life and we'll have him for the following year.
The Cheltenham Festival is a place that trainers dream to have a horse good enough to compete in. And it's a jockey's fantasy to win there. Denoli had competed in 8 races before his appearance at Cheltenham and had won 6 of them. He was set for the festival with jockey Charlie Swan on his back.
He was a lovely horse. He had very good stride, very good action, very free going. Like, he liked to get on with his job, a bit impatient. He's very clear in the wind, Denoli, which is the main thing for a racehorse, if they're clear in the wind. You couldn't hear a thing, you know, he'd never make a noise or anything. Very, very tough. You know, he'd never know when he was beat. He would always idle in front, but when he'd feel a horse coming, he'd pick up and go again. And he was just a very, very tough, genuine horse. He didn't have the big name when I first started riding him. I won a maiden hurdle on him, and he just got better and better. He finished 2nd in the Irish Champion Hurdle when he was a novice, and not too many novices would go that route running the Irish Champion Hurdle. Then he went and won a Grade 1 at Leopardstown in February, about 6 weeks before Cheltenham. And I suppose I was after telling everybody that he was my banker for the meeting, and of course I probably put more pressure on myself then because he was the Irish banker.
Charlie Swan wasn't the only one nervous about Danoli's big day out in Cheltenham. Tom Foley, his trainer, was a bit addled about it too.
Very, very nervous about when we were going to fly him to Cheltenham, what way he'd behave and all in it. Because he wasn't always, say, the easiest in the world in a box. He could just get a little bit worked up and that and all. And it made me nervous whether he'd travel well in a plane and all. So he walked up into the plane and you'd think he was ahead all his life. Now, right, the first time we went, I think it was 21 or 2 horses was on the plane that day.
Right.
And he fitted in with them and all, but he got top priority that time. Mm. They asked me where I wanted them to go and that, and I was quite happy because there's a little place on the plane where the people that's looking after the horses can stand in and all.
Right.
And I said that's where I want them, where we could stand beside them the whole way travelling over and that. And he was quite contented. It was my first time either, and I didn't think about because I was worried about him.
You know, the English really got to that, like, yeah. You know. And Tom never been to England as well, or never on a plane. And then when he went to England, he was sick on the plane going over and everything, like.
No, don't only hit him anyway in the head.
Yeah, that's right.
Big cut across here.
Well, the English were lovely to us.
Yeah.
They really
and Cheltenham was lovely as well. They were lovely, yeah. They were very good.
They were very good.
Going into the race, it was a fair bit of pressure now. I won't deny that there was a lot of pressure, but it was great to get the leg over an horse like him.
And Denoli is favourite, but drifting at 15-8. Then they go 8-1 Brief Gale, 12 Carouge, Dorrance Pride and Morcelli, 14-1 Pondering, 16 Man to Man and Cock Hardy
Affair.
We
were pretty nervous that time because there were 6 races gone. Ireland was after winning no race that day. And we were in the Hunter's Rest that night in Cheltenham, and I remember the television going, and they said that about the races, and they said Ireland no winner, but they have the Noli tomorrow. And I tell you, we started thinking then, you know, because that was the first time we felt pressure.
Come on!
That's it. They're away. And racing towards the first, Elaine...
Watching the race, and I had my eyes shut. I could not watch him. And my brother was beside me, and he said at one stage, God, he hit that one hard. That's good now. He won't hit the next one, you'll find.
The first disputing it with Denoli right up there with him as well in fourth. Denoli fourth, and just in behind them is Cockardy Affair as they come to the next.
Well, I remember on the day, you'd never usually hear the crowd when you're racing because you'd be concentrating that much. But I remember about 6 furlongs out when I was at the top of the hill, I just suddenly heard this roar from the crowd. It was quite shocking, actually. It was just, I've never heard it before.
Denoli hit the front at that flight. And it's Denoli from What a Question. There's a great roar from the crowd as the course commentator announced Denoli having hit the front.
The years went back and he opened his mouth and he was going to fight it out up the hill.
Denoli on the far side being challenged all the time by Dorrance Pride and Carouge coming there on the stand side. Denoli lands in the lead, Dorrance Pride to follow. It's Denoli on the far side, Carouge on the near side. Denoli from Carouge as they race up towards the line. Denoli being challenged all the time by Carouge. Denoli's going to strike the first blow for second, Brief Gale is third, Cockardy Affair is fourth, five.
It was more relief than enjoyment because there was so much pressure on, you know. And obviously I enjoyed it as well, but there was a fair bit of pressure. I suppose then I was lucky later on the day, it made me relaxed. I actually rode 3 winners that day, so it definitely gave me a big boost anyway.
When he crossed the line, because whatever angle I was at, you can't still believe that he won. And I was like, did he win? Did he win? Did he win? And then there was just a mad rush, and you were actually brought with the crowd. And then the job was to try and get back into the parade ring with the horse, because everyone was like, it was like a stampede now, that's the truth. And it kind of, you know, me still wondering, did he win? Did he win? And I was like, God, he must have won, because everyone was just going. And because the Irish had him all backed, and then the reception he got when he came into Cheltenham. And it's only when you actually look back on the videos that you watch and you see, oh my God, all that happened.
Oh, it's a fantastic feeling. You know, everybody's shouting, and you know, you're coming in from Cheltenham, you're coming down that walkway, and you see people that you haven't met for years come out of the woodwork and saying well done to you. It's just, you know, it's a great feeling.
I remember that day in Cheltenham, and this lad came over to me after and he says, the Queen Mother wants to talk to you. And at that time, I didn't care whether it was the Pope or who was it. Meant nothing to me. I was on a high and that was it. But I went up anyhow. They brought me up and there was an awful lot of security and that up along. And they brought me into this room and the Queen Mother was there. And we talked away. Now, I have no idea what we talked about or anything. And I know she was enjoying it anyhow that day. But we came back anyhow, and I don't know who I met, and he says, you know, I says, you're not supposed to ask the Queen Mother anything, like, you're only supposed to answer whatever she says. Well, by God, I said, I didn't do it that way. I said, I talked, I said, the way I said, the same as we were doing all our lifetime. Some of the security lads in that day, right, and whatever we were talking, whatever we said, I know they were laughing to their hearts content. And that was the way it was. I just took it one day at a time, and it made no difference to me who it was. I was as happy as could be at that stage.
And now we have Danoli.
The press reported that the reception given to Danoli that day would have done credit to Arkell himself. Understandably, since he was the subject of one of the biggest gambles ever recorded for the Royal Sun Alliance race. He had captured the hearts of the people. He was the people's champion.
There did an awful lot of people take to him, because probably in the length of time that I know of Cheltenham anyhow, everywhere was closed down on the day he was running in Cheltenham. Even the cattle marts was stopped for the hour when they all had the televisions yoked up. A lot of the schools in there, and there was a good few of the schools was closed up for the day now, but they all had the televisions in the schools and all, and they were let go. And even the priests and all used to bless him, and they were talking about him and all. Father Dowland was the parish priest in Bagnestown now. He blessed him. Well, we used to get blessed every year that time, and he used to come out and do it. But the bishop came out as well. But it was the year that, the second year he was going to Cheltenham, so his blessing wasn't as good as Father Dowland's. He got bit the day that the bishop blessed him. That's right.
They say the ground was very hard that day for the 2:55 p.m. Martel Aintree hurdle on the 8th of April 1995.
It was only when I went to pull him up that I felt him going lame.
I knew when he was coming in from the track into the saddle enclosure that there was something serious wrong with him.
He was being really tough in the race. He had to fight hard to win.
I thought I'd never get the boot off of him. We only stayed a second in the parade ring, and we got him back up to the veterinary box. And when we took the boot off, his tendon was perfect, but the fetlock joint was swelling up as big as could be. He probably, if he had to go another 25 yards, the leg of the boot.
Stayed going, and his leg broke, and he won it.
It was really tough to do what he did. That was the last time I ever rode him, actually.
We got a police escort the whole way in it now, which that wouldn't happen here. And all the roads was closed, stopped. There was policemen going in front. They stopped all the traffic. We got a right of way the whole way. You couldn't believe now, we were travelling with the horse that day, and I just couldn't believe it. But they had the alarm on the horse ambulance, the same as the wood on said for people here, and everyone stands back and they give you the right of way. We were only a half an hour probably getting to the veterinary, and the vets were there. They drove up right to the very door, and they had the x-ray machine, everything. The horse just barely hopped down 5 or 6 foot, and they had the x-ray machine that there. They had him x-rayed, and they had him in a plaster Paris in a matter of 10 minutes.
Should we talk, we'd never race again? But the same horse's leg won't sit.
The Danoli story is a lot more than what he did, like. It's having got injured and then having the resources to come back.
That's where the fairy tale for me starts. To come back from being pinned, a near-fatal injury that he got, and to be as good as he was afterwards. To me, that's what defied him to be the champion and the hardy horse that he was.
Oh, I really think if he was here in Ireland, he wouldn't have had survived. Chris Riggs was his name. He was the vet. And he was unbelievable the way he looked after that horse. And he had an operation and he had, I don't know how many screws put in into the leg, but was all the bone was shattered and they had to take out an awful lot of bits and that in it. Now, he was in it from April until June over there. And we went over a couple of times to see him, but Chris Reed said that nobody take out the horse or nothing. And the reporters over there sat at the gate looking to get in to take photographs and talk to people now, but there was no one let in.
She didn't like it was like someone in the family. It was like someone was dying because we got mass cards and letters. Honestly. And you should see the pictures from Liverpool. They sent us over pictures and everything. The vet, Chris Riggs, they came over here and everything. They were really good. And the whole around his whole stable was all these get well wishes from English and Irish people. And we even got letters here, just then only.
A couple of months after, he flew over in a small plane to Kilkenny and came up to see the horse. Mm. He put a lot into him. Well, I think he knew the horse that he was and... there was going to get a lot of coverage in that. And I think only for him, the horse would never have come back to race. Because he said to me after, when we started the horse back, he said, really, he says, I only done him for to be a pet.
7-1, 10-1. But Denoli wasn't the sort of horse who would be content in just being a pet. Tommy Tracy's a local Carlow jockey and had been involved in the horses since he was a young fellow. He would have helped school Denoli and was on Denoli's back for his first race after injury.
I worked in Denny Cardell Laverax, and Denny's was 2 minutes from Tom's. And Tom got injured, he broke his leg, and we started helping him at dinner time and go down and riding out with him. And I schooled Denoli, jumped him over hurdles and sat in him a few times. I'd say I've never rode a tougher horse in my life, and I think that's what defied him from the rest, the other horses that he raced against.
His first run back was the Irish Champion Hurl. It happened in April, and the Irish Champion Hurl wouldn't have been, I think, until January. And that was his first run back. Yeah. And that day, we never jumped them from the time it happened in Liverpool. We were afraid to. We went up to the Irish Champion Hurl in Leperstown, and I remember when we leading him up along, I just said, we'll bring him down and we'll show him the hurl just that he'll remember it. So we got halfway from where we were down to the hurl, and he decided he wanted to get to the parade ring, and off he took Woodies and on to the parade ring. So we said that day, Tommy Tracy rode him that day, and I said, no, don't hit him, I said. The horse is not to be hit, matter what. I said, let him run whatever way he wants. I said, I just want him to enjoy himself today. Mm. And we got beat by a short head and a head. We could have won it if we had to go out and run him like what we usually do. So we were all kind of so relieved that he was back.
It was like he won because he was back.
The relief and joy of the O'Neill family and Tom Foley was immense. Their Sun, Moon and Stars was back. But Denoli's leg was always giving him jip, and it would be painful and sore after a hard race.
I remember him, we getting him ready for the Hennessy. The horse, he'd get out there and he'd go down and he'd work, but he'd come back up to the stable and he'd be very sore for the day after.
Denoli had spent the first year of his successful racing career running in the bumpers. He then progressed to racing over hurdles until 1996, after recovering from injury, when he began a career in steeplechasing. His first major success in this event was winning the Denny Gold Medal Chase. He was then set for the prestigious Hennessy Gold Cup.
All these competitive graded races are tough. Jesus, the Hennessy Gold Cup is, it's mega in Ireland. It's a Gold Cup.
Number 2, Denoli, Tommy Tracy. Number 3, Idiot's Bench.
There was 4 Gold Cup horses in at that time. And we had very little chance of beating the Tot anyhow. But we went out and we got out to make it. No, well, not exactly to make it, but be up there.
And last year's Gold Cup winner Imperial Call, the favourite here at even money. Jadami, three times a previous winner of this race, 9-2. Denoli is 6 from 7.
Even thinking about it, and it's a while ago now, I can remember fence by fence.
On the way in the Hennessy Cognac Gold Cup, and Denoli goes into the lead from the Grey Monk as they come to the first of these 17 fences.
He led.
We were a kind of joint leader the whole way through.
And then he made a mistake.
And as Corden, as one died away, another came up and took us on then.
It's Venture and King of the Gales as they come to the first with the ditches. Denoli about half a length up, Mary Gale going into it.
He was just so tough. And when horses thought they had him bet, he'd eyeball them. Little things just to fight him. He was like Rocky Balboa in the boxing ring. He was never bet. He'd die for you, and he'd guts to burn. He'd a heart as big as an elephant.
Idiot's Venture. They've 7 fences to jump now, and Denoli back upsides the Grey Monk. 2 lengths away, Mary Gale. Denoli and the Grey Monk from Mary Gale, Imperial Calls in 4.
When something came to take it off me, I could turn a gear and say, come on. Because I knew that the last thing he'd do was give up.
Denoli and the Grey Monk together.
You'd burn off horses with him.
Denoli and the Grey Monk's on the floor. The Grey Monk's a faller.
And then a horse fell beside him, and
the sprinter might be faster for a little while, but the long distance runner could run at a pace for so long, and Denoli was no different.
Denoli lucky to get away with that one as Imperial Call jumps past him.
Then Imperial Call out jumped him, and
4 lengths away, Jadami, Belmont King.
If something was there and you didn't want it there anymore, you could just drop him down the gear like a fast car.
At the fourth last, Denoli on the inside.
It's like everyone in the race took a turn at taking him on, and he kind of saw them all off.
Behind Jadami comes Mary Gale as they go towards the final ditch. 3 from home in the Hennessy Cognac Gold Cup, and Denoli half a length in front of Imperial Call, and they're 8-9 lengths in front of Jadami at the final ditch now. And it's Denoli the leader over from Imperial Call. They're clear of Jadami. Mary Gale in fourth, a long way back to Belmont King, who's being pulled up as they run towards the second last in the Hennessy Cognac Gold Cup.
It's like any man going to work. If you have the right tool, it makes things a lot easier.
At the second last in the Hennessy, Denoli and Imperial Call together. Denoli lands just in front, Imperial Call in second, and starting the run now into the straight. Denoli the leader, going on 3-4 lengths clear of Imperial Call. Jadami's not out of it yet, staying on in third, and they're a long way clear of Mary Gale as they race towards
Jadami. Kept closing, and you nearly were like trying to push the line back to him, like, come on, because he was closing on him, but he held him like he was never going to pass him, as Tom Tracy said. He was never going to pass him.
A big challenge on the near side at the final fence. Denoli and Jadami. Denoli over in front, Jadami in second, Imperial Call back in third, and under one in. Denoli over on the rail, Jadami on the near side, and racing into the closing stages. Denoli and Tommy Tracy from Jadami and Norman Williamson. They're clear of Imperial Call and racing up to the line. Denoli getting a huge reception as they go to the line. Denoli, Jadami still coming, but Denoli's holding him as they go to the line. Denoli wins the NBC Cognac Gold Cup. Tommy Tracy clutches the air with delight. Second Jadami, a long way back to Imperial Call.
To see the people when he came in after the Hennessy, to see the people, what were there and the clapping, there wasn't standing room in the parade ring.
I'll never in my career witness anything like what I witnessed when I came back into the parade ring after winning. The support from the public, the roar he got and the cheers we got on the day coming in, I'll never ever, or I don't think anyone. You'd have to be there, but it's even now, and it's a long time ago. It's 97. It still puts the hair standing on the back of my neck, and I'm so lucky that I had him.
I think that was actually the best race he ever ran.
Oh, it was. Yeah, even better than though I know it was great to win in Cheltenham, but definitely after the broken leg, the Hennessy, and it was one of the best Hennessys, and they have said that was ever run.
In fairness to Tom Foley, he got the horse back to. Yeah. Because he put some work into the horse, he did, and had to get him back and to run in a grade one, like, you know, and to win it as well. It was the people that actually made the horse, because, you know, it really was. Like, it just took to him, and that was it. He wasn't our horse, he was everyone's horse, really. Sure, lad led in the horse, but didn't even know who led him in. He was still don't know, watching him on the video. This lad is actually leading him in. Do you know on the video of the race?
Still don't know who he is.
Still don't know who he is, like, leading him in. And he's smiling like you think he actually and was the owner.
From Galway, Daddy, do you remember him? He used to always come over to us, you know. And this, he was real small. And he was a lovely man. But I had a hat on me that day, now, believe it or not. And when he won, I just threw the hat up in the air. And the little man from Galway came and we were with my hat. I didn't care, but never got it.
Racing delirium as Dunoli has the call, wrote the journalists. A reception that would have disturbed the seismologists. Dunoli was a celebrity. Parties were organised in his honour and he was invited to open shops and show his face at community events.
The people in Moishill are, when they decide to do something, to do it very, very well. But they had a big parade that day and they had the lorry and everyone get up on it and it was very, very exciting.
Locals organised that now, in fairness to them. That was another great night. Brian on a trailer, a big huge trailer, and they had the priests and a lad from Tullow used to do impressions of the commentary of the race, so you could, he actually did that night as well. So the village was packed, the whole street was just full, and then a night in Moishill then after that. And I'd say it was the only time we had a party in this house that we didn't get in trouble for. You go up and go into first mass and there's still people here.
The county council here, they gave him a do as well. There wasn't too many things now he didn't get. And he won the top champion hurler in Europe that year. You know, we had to go over to England to receive that. And he probably was the only horse ever was in RTE at the Late Late Show and walked in around where Gabe Byrne was. He was a queer kind of a horse because in Carlow they were opening up one of the big stores in there, and that's, you know, would bring him in. Mm. And they wouldn't be satisfied unless we brought him in and walked him around in it. And he went in and he walked around in the store the very same as if it was going out into a field of grass. And the same in RT, when the Late Late Show, he walked around in it, not a bother, wondering what was the next thing for him. He seemed to take to everything that was going. He went everywhere. He went to, well, we went to Longford with him. We went off down Cork. We could have been on the road all the time with him if we wanted it.
He ran in 7 races after his glorious victory in the Hennessy in 1997. He fell twice, unseated Tommy Tracy once, but was never out of the top 3 in the other races. However, his owner and trainer were becoming concerned about his leg.
Well, he was 12 years of age, and we thought he was after doing enough. He certainly did more than his share.
The leg was coming against him and he was getting...
We were afraid he'd have to be put down.
And we didn't want him hurt on the track.
We didn't want that to happen.
If he had to be put down on a track, well, we'd never forgive ourselves, and the chances the public would never forgive us either. And I didn't want that to happen. If he went out and was only in a field and coming back in the stable and all, I don't think he'd have enjoyed life at all.
And so, with his best interests at heart, Dunoli was set to live out his retirement at the salubrious environment of the Irish National Stud in Kildare.
There's one of our tours there now. We have a tour guide system going on here all summer long.
It's great.
And that's
it?
Where Dunoli and Vintage Crap and the boys all loved it.
Yeah.
It's because of these groups of people like these would be going around all day long. You know, the foreigners, the Americans and the Canadians and all those people, and they're mad into their horses and sure they'll be giving them carrots over the fence.
Would they, yeah?
People that never would have got to see him in the flesh got to see him, which was a nice too for them.
And
like
school children from Dublin and that. It was great.
Even children from around here.
Yeah.
Young going on school tours up to see him.
There was always people in around there, and in the wintertime they were brought in and out of the stable and all, and the staff up there looked after them very, very well. Mm. You know, they did think a lot of them.
He arrived here. Him and Vintage Crap came around the same time. They were the pioneers of the retired racehorses coming here to stay in the National Stud. And they love it here because they're out in the paddocks most of the day. And on the summertime, they're out all day and night. coming into sort of springtime there, we would put a little light rug on them, or a pyjamas type thing like that. So it's a really good hotel for them.
Paul Hughes looked after the old age pensioners at the National Stud, and it soon became clear that their two residents at that time, Dunoli and Melbourne Cup winner Vintage Crop, had become firm friends.
Said there's the field that we're in now. That's the field. That's the field that the two lads were in now for most of my time with them. And if I wanted to take either one of them in there now to show somebody, I might take them out as far as just here behind us. But as you can see there, they'd always be in sight of each other, like, so yeah. That wouldn't be a problem. But now if I tried to take one of them way up the avenue and left one behind, I'm not so sure whether who'd have the most trouble. Like, the guy behind would be a two-way thing, like, you know what I mean? Like, I might have difficulty bringing the guy up the avenue. Indeed, he might want to go up at all. And then I'd have the other fella maybe in the field here running around shouting and roaring and crying and wanting another. So, yeah, they spent their whole time together.
The two of them were inseparable. Even the toys, like, if that time they used to bring around to different place, the shows and things like that. And Vintage Cop was going flat, harsh, you know. And they'd have to bring Dunoli with them. And if it's on the other way, if they had Dunoli in place, they'd bring Vintage Cop with them. Two horses were inseparable. You see how the one trough.
I brought Dunoli to Bagnallstown in Carlow one year for there was a flower weekend festival down there. He paraded up the town and that. I also brought Vintage Crop to Leopardstown to another daffodil there, something like that. And Dunoli would go with him. So they sort of followed each other around the country as companions, because they're sharing the same paddock all the time. And it's not fair to bring one without the other. When you'd be doing your thing with Dunoli, he did it better, as in, say, walking up the road. He didn't have to have the other lad walking along beside him, but we'd always keep him an eye shut.
Yeah.
Or he'd have a little peep now and again to see, could he see him? And once he seen him, he was difficult to hard, heavy horse to handle and all that. Would he be less likely to be like that once the other guy was with him? They get to depend on each other, I suppose, too, because they're elderly, like, and they probably seek comfort from each other. Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good day.
Good day.
How are you going?
Tom Foley and the O'Neill family came regularly to the National Stud to visit their old pal, Dunoli.
We were told any time we wanted, we just could walk up and in and go see him, so we seen him pretty often.
And for a while, Tom helped out with bringing him places.
I remember one day we had to go down Cork with him, and I said to the lads in the Ashford, I'd collect him and I'd bring him down the night before, you know, to have it handier for it to go the next day. We brought him home that night, and the next day we were going out to saddle up horses, and the minute he seen the saddle, he lost his head talk. He was back in working again, and he went mad. So he went back to the National Stud the next day, and he never settled in. He wouldn't eat or nothing, so they wouldn't hesitate to bring him anymore. It upset him too much. He really wanted to get back to go racing again, yeah. And he loved it.
These five here, mm-hmm. And these few here.
Yeah.
They, during the winter times, when they're paddocked out here in front of us, this would be their housing here, like.
Okay.
Here was Dunoli. That's where he spent his time in there now, down in this yard.
He was in number one.
Yeah.
And Beef or Salmon is here now.
Yeah, yeah. Do you see what I mean? Someday you might be coming down here, unfortunately, and something else will be in there, you know.
On the 26th of April 2006, Dunoli, aged 18, contracted a severe bout of colic.
We were all around him, yeah, sure. I mean, our vets were with him, and we knew you're depending on the vets then, and sure, it's a waiting game then. And unfortunately, with horses at that sort of age, the mortality rate is high, like, you know.
Oh yeah, they rang here and said he got it, and they were bringing him to the hospital, and then they rang back and said they had to put him down. Yeah, the vet said there could be nothing done for him.
Yeah.
Oh, that was really bad news, no? Mm-hmm. But sure.
I was in Donegal playing Camogie with Stephen Trasa, at the Pan Celtic Festival. And actually, oh my God, it was like, and everyone was, we were out that night and everyone was asking, what's wrong with you? And I couldn't say it because I knew if I said it, I'd just burst out crying. And then eventually I said it. So it was like one the family did. Like, you know, it was. I know, like, it was horrible. Yeah, it was horrible. It was horrible, yeah.
They rang me here at 4 o'clock and I got into the car and I went up, and by the time I was up, he was dead.
Donnelly is dead 7 years now, but his exploits on the racecourse still provide inspiration and delight to his jockeys like Charlie Swan and Tommy Tracy.
To me, as a jockey, to come across one in a lifetime, to be lucky enough, I was lucky enough to be associated with very good horses, and I've ridden Australia and all over the world, France and everywhere, and to be lucky enough to get him at such a young age. And to be part of the story of the Donnelly is brilliant, you know.
Well, he's definitely up there with the best. So I obviously rode Istabrak as well, you know. But Donnelly, you know, you'd have to say that he was definitely up on my top three horses anyway. It's always sad when you lose, you know, such a great horse. But, you know, it happens with all, unfortunately.
It's life, be it human or be it equine or be it, you know, you never know. But he had a great life, and it's probably eerie and stupid, but it's my belief someday I'll sit in him again. I'm a firm believer.
And would you be thinking about him often?
Yes, I do. Especially the bad days, or if things are not going well race-wise, I'd often stick him on and watch him, yeah. Even thinking about him now, it sometimes it hurts to know, like, such a good... He'd a great racing career. And when he's gone, to miss him so much, it's hard to... I had a great infinity with him.
Up in the National Stud, his old pal Vintage Crop was given special minding after his death.
When Donnelly passed away, you had to keep your eye on Vintage Crop then, hadn't you, to make sure, like, that he wasn't going around fretting a bit or that, like. So you tried to get something else. We have a mare in with them all now. Tudor Loom is her name. We call her a nanny mare. She's a mare that's retired from breeding. We owned her, so she's living on the farm here. So she's handy for filling the gap, if you like. It's all about company, like, at that later stage of their life. It's about company.
Three from home in the Hennessy Cognac Gold Cup. In all, Donnelly ran 32 races. He won 17, was second 3 times, third 6 times, and fourth once. He was never out of the top 4 when he stayed on his feet. Now he's never out of his trainer Tom Foley's head.
Yeah, definitely you'd always be thinking of him. But I know myself, there's top trainers that went to their lifetime and deserved a good horse and never got him. We were steeped in luck to get a horse like him. And I remember every race, and I remember what way he done it and all like that, and that's the way I wanted to have it with him. I never wanted a horse to take his place. I'd love that one as good, but there's no horse that'd ever take his place. Never. That's him there now. I got some of the... That's some of his mane there, the hair all of his mane and that there.
And that's the end of the Donnelly story. A story about a horse whose spirit and passion was recognised, nurtured and sustained by a dedicated group of people who loved him dearly.
Mad About Donnelly
on KCLR.
Produced by Monica Hayes, Mad About Donnelly contains horse racing commentary from BBC Sport.
Made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland.